I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jacqueline Beauvoir, Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story. It's a new book by Barbara Leeming, and three of her biographies have been New York Times Notable Books of the Year. Churchill Defiant was the book she wrote before this one. She's also author of Jack Kennedy, The Education of a Statesman, Mrs. Kennedy, The Missing History of the Kennedy Years, Marilyn Monroe, Orson Welles, a biography, and many other books. Barbara has written for the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, The Times of London, and other publications. And the book has been getting a lot of attention for this significant part of the story, that Jackie Kennedy for 31 years fought a battle with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a detailed account of this part of Jackie's story for the first time, and many other parts of her story as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Barbara. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and it's also true that we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Barbara. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I always find everything about the Kennedys so fascinating. I found your book. I didn't get to all of it, but I read a good chunk. Extremely fascinating. And let's start with the assassination and the days after the assassination, because the enormity of the grief and what Jackie did on, I believe it was December 2nd, after the November 22nd assassination, taking the remains of the two children who had died and planting them in Arlington. And I just can't even imagine the enormity of the grief. And to boot, she's, you know, this public symbol of this pain that everybody's feeling in the country.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary story to write because, I mean, let me tell you just one little thing before we talk about that. 15 years ago, I was at the Bodleian Library at Oxford, and I read a correspondence. I'd been told that there was a correspondence between Jackie and former British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan there. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I read a letter which I couldn't get out of my head for 15 years. Mm. And that letter was from Prime Minister Macmillan to Jackie, written right after the assassination. It was a condolence letter. And when you said the grief, it was a letter to a grieving widow. And yet it seemed to me an extremely odd letter. I mean, Macmillan was talking to her and comparing what had happened to Jackie in Dallas to the experience that soldiers have in war. He was talking about his own experience as a soldier in the First World War. He had been grievously wounded in the First World War. And he was going on and on and on about war and soldiers and what happens to them and their relationship to God afterwards. And I thought, what is he doing? Why is he talking to her like this? And then I saw Jackie's letter of response. And in the first letter of response that she wrote to him, she said to Macmillan, "This is the most important letter that anyone has written to me. This is the most important letter of my life. This is the letter that saved my life." And I thought, if she's responding like that, this is important. And then for years afterwards, she was quoting the letter. She was talking about the color of the ink. And I started to think about this, and I thought, what is going on? And while I was writing the biography of President Kennedy, I was talking to people who had known Jackie very, very intimately in the years after the assassination. And what they were telling me about her was not fitting in with the other accounts that I'd heard. I mean, it was clearly a very different story. And I started to also read about post-traumatic stress disorder. And I started to read the scientific literature because it was something that was appearing in the news all the time. And I eventually realized that what I was hearing about Jackie and what I was reading in her own letters, because I saw a lot of letters that people hadn't seen before, what I was reading in her letters and what I was hearing was exactly the same sort of thing that you hear with the soldiers returning when you hear about post-traumatic stress disorder. And I realized, oh my goodness, this woman had all of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, except at that point there was no such diagnosis at all. not until 1980. And I realized that this was a really, really, really important story to write, and to write right now, because we have in this country, obviously, a crisis of PTSD with all of the young soldiers and older soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's really important for us to understand what it is to suffer from PTSD now. And Jackie's life story puts a name and a face to PTSD. And it's in that sense very much a story for a time. And that really is why I went to it. And then went back, of course, to what you're talking about, which is tracing it day by day, basically, for 30 years.
Yeah, a large task. And when you talk about PTSD, I'm wondering what she did in this regard. You write about the struggle to avoid anything that might trigger memories of the bloodbath in Dallas, which consumed her life. How do you avoid those kinds of memories? I mean, do you drink a lot? Do you take drugs? What do you do?
Well, she did all of those things. But I think that what's very important and what I learned while I was, really I learned it from Jackie, because she has the language to convey not just what it's like to suffer from PTSD in so that you see it, you feel it with her. And one of the things that was very important was to understand what she meant when she said she was having a flashback, or when someone described her having a flashback. I mean, a PTSD flashback is not a memory like you or I would say, oh, I remember last year such and such happened. I mean, Jackie Kennedy was somebody whose husband's head was literally blown apart in her face, and she was bathed in his blood and brains. And when she would have a flashback, she would literally be back in the car in Dallas, and she would smell the blood again, and she'd feel the heat. And the first time I was really conscious of somebody seeing that was in something that happened right after the assassination. Most people remember the very famous Camelot interview that Jackie gave right after the assassination, when she put forth the myth of Camelot. And Teddy White, who was the journalist from Life magazine who did that interview, left behind notes of that interview, things that he didn't print. And one of the things that Teddy White described in there, and it was obviously very, very upsetting for him. He didn't understand what he'd seen, but he knew, like I knew, that letter of Macmillan's was important. He knew he was seeing something strange. And what White said was this, that when she was sitting, the interview took place up at Hyannis, and he said when she was sitting in the room with him, and what he called the blood scene, when the blood scene would suddenly take over, what happened was that he realized, she's not talking to me. She's not even in this room. She's in that car in Dallas. And that's what a flashback is like. You are literally reliving it. And, of course, that's horrible for somebody to see, because they can't reach you. And certainly it was something that I heard friends of Jackie's telling me was incredibly painful for them in the aftermath. I remember Betty Spaulding, who was a good friend of both Jack and Jackie, saying to me that, yes, it was horrible listening to the gory details. I mean, Jackie would endlessly, she couldn't control it. She would endlessly talk about the ridges in Jack's brain and stuff. And Betty said, you know, I'd be getting sick listening to this. But also she said, what was so awful was I just wanted to do something for her. And like White, she realized, this woman isn't here. I love her, but I can't touch her. And that's awful. And so your life does become consumed with trying to avoid these kind of moments in your life. And Jackie, I mean, literally moved from Washington to New York very shortly after the assassination, thinking, oh, I'll escape from this. And I remember there was one story where she said, right after she got to New York, the Warren Commission report is going to be in the newspaper. All right, I know that's going to be bad. That's going to trigger a flashback. So what she did was to cancel the newspaper very carefully, but then she went to the hairdresser's, and there sitting on the table was, of course, something. So you can't do it. You can't stop it. And so what happens next, and what happened with Jackie, was that you just shut yourself off from as much emotion as you possibly can, even things that formerly gave her pleasure. I mean, I remember sitting in my office one day with the tears streaming down my face, reading a letter of Jackie's where she's talking about, just wish I could go on a trip and feel what I used to feel. You know, it was fun for me. I liked that kind of thing. And she doesn't feel anything except anger. And the reason you feel anger and rage, and she was violent. I mean, her sister describes being hit by her.
Yes.
I mean, she was violent in the way that you know, sometimes hear that the soldiers have this tremendous anger because that is what protects you from the next attack. Jackie spent 30 years waiting for the next attack to come, and therefore the only emotion that's safe for you is anger. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing to live with, and imagine living with it when no one had a clue in the world what was wrong with her. Mm-hmm. I mean, they thought she was crazy.
And then she had to deal with all the horrors that were subsequent to the JFK assassination, Bobby's assassination in 68, which was, as you write, another trigger for her.
Yes. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to somebody who has had a traumatic experience is for that traumatic experience to be repeated. Because what happens to you when you're in that car, like Jackie was, is you are utterly helpless. You're completely helpless. And that's a terrifying human experience. I mean, we don't like to think that our lives are that far out of control. We like to think that we have control over things. And at the moment, I mean, we can literally see that moment of utter helplessness with Jackie. Remember the picture, I mean, it's been published a million times, of Jackie on the back of the car in that pink suit,
right,
trying to get out. I mean, that's the moment, that's the one moment that she didn't remember. And usually the reason you don't remember in something like that, in that kind of trauma, is that it's a moment when there is literally an awareness that there is nothing you can do, and so you just dissociate from it. And we've seen that. And so for that to be repeated with Bobby was horrific for Jackie. But in addition to that, that was the moment when the United States turned on her. And that's when she decided to marry Aristotle Onassis, which was completely in reaction to the Bobby assassination. Not only was she re-traumatized, but then she was attacked for something that, when we look back at it now, you think, how did we not understand? I mean, there was a letter that I read from Jackie to Robert McNamara, who was very much one of her protectors, and probably the most important protector except for Bobby in the post-war, in the post-assassination period. And in that letter, after Bobby was killed, she's about to announce that she's marrying Onassis, she is talking about being annihilated and how she knows she's going to be annihilated and there is nothing she can do except accept that fact. It's going to happen. She keeps talking to him about her comrades and love and blood. It's just saturated with blood imagery. And there was another letter written in this period to Joe Alsop, who is a journalist and a longtime friend of Jackie's. And she says to Joe, I will never allow myself to love again. I will never care about anyone. She was not marrying Onassis for love. She was marrying him because he was one of the richest men in the world. He had his own Air Force, his own island, his own security force, as much power as most people in the world can even imagine. And she thought if there was anybody who could keep her and the children safe,
yeah,
possibly, it was that. And what did we say? She sold herself to the highest bidder.
Mm-hmm.
She's killed Jack Kennedy again. I mean, mm-hmm, I cringe when I remember what I felt at that time. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the country did turn on her. He was, I didn't realize that he was to become the richest man in America. So in a way, she must have thought that riches could protect her, could keep her away from all harm in terms of security forces, in terms of riding on the Mediterranean or wherever on big yachts, mm-hmm, that you're just away from the rest of the world.
Yep, you think so. And interesting enough, in the beginning, I think she did feel better with him. It turned very, 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 very bad because,
right,
his son was killed in a plane crash, and he turned on Jackie at, mm-hmm, that moment and began to think that maybe she had brought with her something, you know, a very
curse,
kind of primitive curse.
Yeah.
And, I mean, by the time that the Onassis marriage was over, I mean, Onassis died in 1975, her friends said that Jackie knew she had to do something, and that what she did at that moment, which was very, very important, was she had to do it for herself. She somehow realized that all of this turning to somebody else to protect her hadn't worked. And it's actually the last part of her story is a remarkable story of survival at a moment when nobody knew what was wrong with her. She basically put together for herself a way of you never get rid of PTSD. You just don't get rid of it. But she found a way of remarkably controlling the intrusions and so forth to a degree that's astonishing and making a meaningful life for herself and for her children.
Yeah.
So it's an incredible story. I mean, she turns out to be this very brave woman.
And it's interesting that she turns it around in some regards because she becomes a working woman, right? She's working.
Absolutely, and I think that was enormously important for her because it established a routine in her life, and routine is something that, you know, predictability, that kind of thing is really important. But the particular job that she had also, it couldn't have been more tailor-made for someone with PTSD. I mean, she had a natural talent as an editor. I've seen a lot of her stuff with her markings on it. She had that as a talent. But why editing was obviously so, so important for her was, if you're an editor, you can make the story come out the way you want it to come out. You
right.
can change it.
Right.
And if you've been through what she was through in that car in Dallas, and if you spent the nights that she spent, and I know she did this, going over and over trying to change that story, what an incredible job to have. You can fix those stories up. Mm. And I think that was a really, really interesting thing. It was, I mean, obviously it's a feminist story, but it's also a PTSD survivor story in a remarkable way.
Oh, it's fascinating. And when you talk about going over, she indeed did things like, oh, if I had only known that first shot was a gunshot. Oh, if I had only pushed him down after that gunshot. She felt as though she bore some responsibility. Do you think?
Yeah, that took me a long time to understand that, and it's very, very important because she did night after night and with the friends and everything. If only I had known the backfire. It was not a backfire; it was a gunshot. You would rather, if something like that happens to you, it's so awful, it's so out of your control that one of the things that tends to happen is that you'd rather feel guilty than feel that you're that helpless. So that's what survivor's guilt is. When you hear a soldier talk about survivor's guilt, you know, why was it not me and instead of my friend, or why was it not Jackie instead of Jack?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she went through that because it's easier to feel that guilt, and guilt is horrible. I mean, it's a tremendous, tremendous burden. I mean, she was just racked with guilt in the aftermath of the assassination.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Barbara. Barbara, as you can tell, is the author of a very interesting book. You think you've read every take on the Kennedys that you could possibly imagine, and then you get something that's very new. Barbara Leeming's latest book is Jacqueline Beauvoir Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who have memories of that November in 1963, and memories particularly of her, because we do have these images with the two young children and John doing the salute and Jackie carrying the nation, and so many commentators saying that she really, her steadfastness, we needed that because our pain was very strong, and she had to have this composure about her. And then the fall from grace, people paid attention to this life and to the tragedy of the Kennedys. So what do you think about Barbara's interpretation here that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and suffered from it for a long, long time? We have yet to talk about her relationship. We'll talk more about with Robert McNamara. Certainly there's been a lot of gossip about her relationship with Bobby. We'll talk about that. And other issues, the early, what happened in the days after the assassination, too, and her going to religious figures for advice. The bishop, I think he was a bishop, later an archbishop, who did her burial service, but who did JFK's burial service, her questions to him. It remains fascinating, at least to me, and I'm sure to many of you as well. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're going to go to phone calls. Barbara Leeming is our guest, and we're talking about Jacqueline Bouvier. I'm sorry, I was mispronouncing that. I don't speak French. Bouvier, Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. Let's start our calls with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Find it a fascinating program. That poor woman, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I would like to ask your guest what Jacqueline Kennedy, if she ever expressed an opinion, thought of all the conspiracy theories that continue to swirl about.
You know, that was a very interesting thing, because I think that one of the things that happens in the aftermath of an assassination like that and of a trauma is that we would rather think that there was an explanation, some sort of logical, rational explanation for something that's basically irrational. It's almost unthinkable. She said at one point that she didn't care who did it. She didn't care. She only cared that she had lost her husband and that this thing had happened. I think the last thing that was on her mind in the aftermath was who had done it. And Bobby, I think, said very much the same thing. She was consumed with staying alive. I mean, she was consumed with stopping herself from killing herself. I mean, as Kathleen said before, one of the things that she said right in the spring after the assassination, when she was she was waking up every night screaming with nightmares. She was drinking to try and fall asleep, and then it wasn't helping. She was doing what soldiers do when they're talking about PTSD. They'll tell you about a lot of them are drinking too much, taking drugs. Jackie was doing anything that she could to make this get out of the car in Dallas. And there was a moment in the spring of 1964 when I think she really very seriously did consider killing herself. She had just been through a whole series of interviews with William Manchester, the man who wrote The Death of a President. They were the only intensive interviews that she did for History in which she talked about what happened in Dallas. And it was clearly too much for her. And what was really strange about it was that William Manchester also was suffering from PTSD. He did not know it for several years, but he then eventually realized that he had been traumatized in Okinawa in 1945 when he was there with the Marines. And so you have these two people who are toxic for each other, and Jackie is desperately trying to forget, and Manchester wants every single detail and is fueling her with diaries, pictures of diaries, to keep her talking and probing and saying, go over this. And by the time those interviews were over, Bobby Kennedy had asked her to talk to a priest friend of theirs because he was so worried about her. And it was right after this intensive grilling about Dallas that she said to the priest, you know, she wanted to kill herself. And ultimately, I think the only reason she didn't was, as she said, because of the children. And
right,
she does say that in her letters, that it was the children who kept her alive. Thank God she had them at that point, because she was in the sort of condition where it could have happened. It's a terrifying thing, but anything to get out of that head. But the last thing I think she was thinking about was who did it. She didn't care.
Thank you, Scott, very much for your call. What about her pouring her concerns? You write about Bishop Hannon, who also gave a mass when she died. Obviously, the ultimate question is how had God allowed her husband to die in that kind of fashion? How could it have happened? Did she get any answers from anybody of faith or not? What did she say about that?
Yeah, that's very, very important. I mean, that was one of the things that McMillan was talking about in that first letter that she got. Why would God let such things happen? And that is something that you think, if you've been through, is how can it, I mean, it obviously makes you question your faith. And she didn't feel that she was getting any answers. There were no answers as far as she was concerned. And that was very, 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 very difficult for her to deal with. And again, I think that kind of questioning is typical. What's interesting about it is that in the aftermath of the assassination, One of the things that I learned a lot from is the correspondence that took place between Robert McNamara and Jackie. And one of the things that McNamara and Jackie did after the assassination was to obsessively read aloud. McNamara would read aloud to Jackie from Ibsen's The Master Builder. And it was clear that the key line in there for them was, why would God allow such things to happen in the world? The two of them were endlessly going over this question of how is it possible? How is it possible that life is as random and often as terrible as it is? And she was obsessed with that, and she was asking the bishop this, but she was also, and anybody that she was talking to intensively about it, she was clearly also talking to them about it. It was one of the things. I mean, the Ibsen play was a kind of lodestone for her and McNamara that they both went back to over the years. She used to refer to him as the master builder. She thought he was both the most wonderful man in the world and also at the same time the most beleaguered. I mean, one of the things that made her so attached to McNamara was that this is the man who's the architect of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most unpleasant aspects of this story because everybody who was close to Jackie, I mean, the two big protectors, both Bobby and McNamara, were both people who loved her but who were using her politically. Bobby, because he was struggling for power with Lyndon Johnson. And it is very clear that as much as he cared about his sister-in-law, he saw her as a political pawn, a very valuable political asset that he had, and he was using her and was willing to use her. And that puts her in a horrible position. McNamara was also very much concerned about her, but also very much concerned about his policies in the Vietnam War, and terrified, as was LBJ, that, I mean, remember, Jackie Kennedy, after Jack is dead, she's the one who has the aura of John F. Kennedy.
Right.
And the last thing in the world they want her to do is to come out and say, well, that was not what Jack was going to do in Vietnam, and they're afraid of that.
Hmm.
And so I remember hearing disgusting conversation, because all of LBJ's phone conversations were recorded. And he and McNamara were talking, and they're talking about some Vietnam question. And LBJ says to McNamara, are you going to see Jackie? And McNamara says, yeah, I'm going up to New York. I'm going to have dinner with her. And LBJ says, are you going to talk to her about this? And he said, yeah, I'll talk to her. And LBJ says, well, make sure she's had a couple of drinks before you do it. And I mean, you think, oh my God, how is this possible? And Jackie, I mean, McNamara is a very powerful man, and I think what drew her to him originally was the fact that he was the man who would always say, I can do it. I know what to do. I mean, his hand, I remember when I was writing President Kennedy's biography, I used to refer to him as the man who has his hand up in the room before he can even ask the question. I mean, I'll volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great for somebody who feels helpless. But then when Vietnam started to go wrong and McNamara was being attacked and Jackie began to believe that he was the one who was trying to stop the war. So she saw him as beleaguered and attacked in the same way that she was. She was being attacked as somebody who was prolonging memories of the assassination, and he was being attacked for Vietnam. And the two of them would sit in the room together and feed on this with each other. And one of the things that they were both asking repeatedly was, why would God allow such things to happen in the world? It's a very complicated political story, this one, and you don't sort of expect to be talking about Jackie Kennedy in those terms. You know, we think about her as her dresses or whatever.
Right.
But there's what I realized in writing it, and particularly in writing it after I've just done the Jack Kennedy book, there's a huge piece of political history that we were missing in the struggle for policy and position after Jack's assassination, that you can't really tell without seeing it with Jackie in the middle of it. I mean, her story, and particularly the McNamara. I don't think, you know, he's the most enigmatic figure, and her correspondence with McNamara, I think, is essential to any portrait of McNamara as well as of Jackie.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Scott, thanks very much for your call. Ray in Black River Falls. Hi.
Good afternoon. Very much enjoying the program. I was in school at the time, parochial school in Minneapolis, on the day that Jack Kennedy was assassinated. And we had just come back from lunch, and a friend of mine lived fairly close to school, and he come running in, and he said, the president's been shot. And we said, you know, don't tell lies like that, because nobody believed that. We got back to class, and the principal, she came on, and she announced that the president had been shot in Dallas, and we all went to prayer then, and about 20 minutes later, she came back in and told us that over the loudspeaker that the president had died in Dallas. And I remember being at home and how serious my parents were, and the time also, you know, the fear because of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Russians, and we just weren't sure who or why. And I remember that tension in the nation and the sorrow, and then, of course, watching the funeral in black and white yet back then on television. And I remember that, and I heard your comments earlier on Jackie didn't really care who did it. Did that ever change over time as when they did when they reopened the Warren Commission? Did she ever question or ever have any idea who did it, or was she just satisfied with what they said?
I don't think that's fascinating that's an interesting way to put it, because I don't think that it was even a question of being satisfied. I think she just turned away from that. But what was so interesting to me just now, as you were talking, was the detail that in which you remember exactly, and you're a child, and you mm-hmm. remember that kind of thing. And I think that that's what's so, you know, when I said in the beginning that this was a national trauma, it was something that we all have seen, at least in the Zapruder film or something like that. And what's interesting about your detail, and I mean, I have the same thing myself before I started writing the book, is that it tells us a lot about how society reacts to a trauma. I mean, we are traumatized by it. We're remembering with the kind of detail that Jackie remembered, because it's our experience of seeing life not being as controllable as
exactly.
we like to think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what happens and what happened to Jackie is because of that, that society at a certain point, people at a certain point want to forget that such traumatic things happen. And so what very often happens is what happened to Jackie, we turn on the victim because she becomes a kind of reminder of this thing. And in Jackie's case, I mean, it did happen. She went from being absolutely idolized. You're talking about the experience of the funeral. And what I loved about what you were saying when you talked about the tension, one of the things that for me was completely surprising, because I believed, like everybody else, you know, this is somebody who is just behaving in the most incredibly dignified manner,
right.
and, you know, and holding us together. And she did. She was a symbol of strength, and she was dignified. But what's in fact actually going on with her there, and if you look at the pictures of her behind the veil. Look at her eyes. She has the thousand-yard stare, which is what the soldiers call it in wartime. What was going on with her then was that she was in full battle mode. She expected another attack. She had been warned that there was probably going to be an assassination attempt if she tried to walk with all of those people behind her. They were sure that somebody was going to shoot at De Gaulle. Suddenly, there had been no Secret Servicemen on the roofs in Dallas, but that had all changed in a matter of days. There are snipers on all of those rooftops hoping that they're going to be able to stop whatever they're expecting to happen. There were rumors that Oswald's brother was in Washington and that he was going to kill somebody. She was a warrior waiting for the attack. She was shut down in that thing. She couldn't cry then. There were no tears that would come because all she's feeling there is the rage and the anger that I talked about before, which is what prepares you to fight or fly. And that's what's going on in there. And it's an extraordinary thing because we were all feeling tense. And just imagine what she is feeling. I mean, she is feeling that it's not over. I've got to hold on here and get through. And she's doing something, you know, absolutely extraordinary, but it's not what we thought. And I couldn't understand why. I saw her say several times in interviews with Manchester, you know, I'm not an actress. I am not an actress. I'm not pretending. And she wasn't. She wasn't holding herself together. She'd say this to, you know, to other people when they praised her for her behavior. She said that was not an act. She couldn't explain exactly what it was, but what it was someone ready to fight. And you look at the tapes of the funeral again, knowing this, and it all reads very, very differently. Mm-hmm. But your vivid memory, I mean, to me, is just utterly fascinating.
Yeah, it's remarkable how we remember that day. Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story, the focus of our hour this hour with Barbara Leeming. It's her new biography. Barbara has written many best-selling books, highly acclaimed biographer of many other people, including another one of Jackie Kennedy and one about Jack Kennedy, also Marilyn Monroe, Orson Welles, and Churchill Defiant, her book before this one. So we'll be back with you momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email again is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Anne in Kenosha. Hi.
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 In listening to you discuss how the nation turned on Jackie and her PTSD, I was struck by the similarities to Mary Todd Lincoln, you know, who is another woman whose husband was shot right next to her. I mean, right next to her. And history is so harsh, calling Mary Todd Lincoln crazy, vilifying her. The whole country turned against her in her later years. It just, to me, the similarities are very striking, and I wondered if that ever occurred to you as you were working on this with Jackie.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think it's a really interesting comparison, and I don't know. At one point I thought I would like to do a book about Mary Todd Lincoln, and I never got to do it. And it was sort of in the back of my mind, and I thought, if I get diverted from this to doing that, I'll never finish this book. But it's an enormously interesting thing because you're fascinated by what I'm fascinated by, which is the way that this story and any story like it tells you something not just about the person involved, not just about Jackie and her reaction to a traumatic event, but to our reaction to it as a society. And, you know, for me, I think the thing that was very strange was even before the Onassis turning, in 1966, we saw something the first time this happened. And it was really, I mean, in many ways for me, it was almost worse than the Onassis because in 1966, it was only 3 years from Jack's assassination. And the time that it happened was that Manchester had finished his book, and that book had been commissioned by Jackie, and she believed that she had control over that book. And she thought that if she decided it was not to be published, it was not to be published. And the reason why she didn't want it to be published was that she said, it will drive me mad if I see this book in the bookstores on the streets as I'm walking down New York, down the streets in New York. If my children see the excerpts on the newsstand, I will go simply mad if this happens. And somehow or other, she said, when I made the decision to commission the book, I was trying to block anybody from doing it, and I wasn't thinking clearly, and I somehow expected for it to go into a dark library shelf, and I would never see it. But by 1966, when Manchester was finished with The Death of a President, which is the book about the assassination, Jackie was no better than she had been at the time, and she was hysterical at the idea of this happening, and so she went to court to block it. And what happened in December of 1966 when she went to court was, for the first time, you started to see the country turn on her. There was a terrible, terrible article published in 1966 in December, which said that Jackie was a professional martyr and said that she was simply performing as an actress, that she was deliberately prolonging the memories of the assassination. And it's the absolute opposite. She's trying to shut it down. I remember her saying in one of her letters then, I am walking around and I'm in a trance. I don't think I will ever feel anything again because this is so horrific. I remember a letter that Bobby wrote after to another friend after the attacks had started on Jackie, when they were telling her that she was trying to prolong the memories of the assassination. And he said, this poor girl who has done nothing is just completely crushed by this. I mean, this was like another attack on her. And by the time that first battle was over, I mean, you just see the toll that this took on her, and you realize that it doesn't take very long for us to feel that we can't stand these memories. Mm-hmm. We want them gone,
right, right.
And we'll do what it takes to do it. I mean, society's reaction to Jackie is really, really important, I think, for history, but also for understanding the nature of trauma.
Well, let's talk about Bobby a moment, because I was thinking about him when you just said what you said. You write, he recovered more quickly, if never completely, for his deep grief, but he condemned her for living too much in the past and even referred to her privately as my crazy sister-in-law.
Yeah, he did. I mean, again, we have to remember that there was no diagnosis of anything like PTSD until 1980. But I think that when you see Jackie and Bobby together in the aftermath of the assassination, you begin to understand something that's a difficult idea to come to terms with. I mean, both of them are grief-stricken. I mean, both of them have lost something that they love, someone that they loved, and neither one of them will ever get over that. But grief is different from trauma, and Bobby is only grief-stricken. Jackie is grief-stricken and traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're grieving, it's about a past that's lost. It's very much you've lost something. That past is gone. And if you're traumatized, the exact opposite is happening. You are locked in that past, and you can't escape from that past. And I think that put the two of them at odds, but it also... there is also a difference in the two of them, and Bobby did have a very strong sense of a future and wanting to get the power that had been lost, he believed, for his family. He believed it was his legacy. As one of his friends said, he behaved like the crown prince. I mean, we don't have royal families in the United States, but Bobby Kennedy forgot that, and I think forgot it in his grief partly too. And so from very shortly after the assassination, he was engaged in this tremendous battle to get back to power. And again, as I said before, Jackie was a very valuable asset in that, and he was used to treating her that way, because one of the very unpleasant parts of the Jack and Jackie story which is why I went through the early part of the of Jackie's life in here, because I think it's important if somebody is living with trauma, you have to understand who they were before so you can understand who they were afterwards. And one of the things that Jackie was a young woman who had been married as a political asset. I mean, Jack Kennedy clearly liked her. He was amused by her. He knew she was a bright person. He thought she was attractive, I suppose. I don't think she was as attractive as some of the people that he was used to being with, but he was certainly not in love with her when he married her. And I think Jackie very quickly realized that she was in love with him. And that was a complicated thing, but she was married because his father and Jack believed that she could be a tremendous political asset. That, unfortunately, didn't quite work out as they were thinking, and there was a lot of fear. And one of the things that, for me, was so sad in things that she said after the assassination was she said she believed, and I think she did believe this, that literally until the day that Jack was killed, she had not completely convinced him, despite Paris, despite South America, despite what she'd done in India, despite the White House thing, she had not completely convinced Jack that she was the political asset he needed. And she believed unless she was that kind of political asset, he would not fully love her. Hmm. And she said the day in Dallas when he died, he believed. Finally, he believed, and he was about to have a real marriage with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether she was talking herself into this or not, she had agreed to go with him on a domestic political trip to California 2 weeks afterwards. That was of huge symbolic importance to her. And what she said, which is heartbreaking, is, I was about to have it all, and it was all snatched out from under me in an instant, and there was nothing that I could do about it. And I mean, your heart breaks when you hear this. I mean, is she, you know, how does she live the rest of her life thinking, I was about to have it, and it, not that I have it, I was about to have it, and it was snatched away. I mean, it's a really sad story.
And you end the book with her diagnosis of cancer, and it's an interesting story as well, how she handled news of her impending death.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing thing. I think by the time that she got the diagnosis of cancer, and I mean, she was remarkably brave and continued to work and so forth until almost the very end. I think that she had found a kind of peace that's, I mean, just utterly remarkable, really awe-inspiring, because she said actually in the last days to McNamara, of all people, you know, it doesn't matter what people think of you. No one, she invoked Eleanor Roosevelt, and she said, no one can humiliate me without my consent. And I think that was very, very important for her. He had not reached that point, but she had. And not only had she done that, but she said something it's my favorite moment in the Jackie story, because it's maybe the happiest moment. In 1980, she was at a dinner party, and one of the men at the dinner party looked at her and said, oh, Mrs. Onassis, you know, what do you think is your proudest achievement? And clearly the man thought that she was going to say, you know, I redecorated the White House, or
right.
I conquered Paris, or I, you know, whatever they thought she was going to say. And instead, she looked at him and said, you know, without missing a beat, she said, my proudest achievement, I kept my sanity.
Hmm.
And I mean, that's, you know, that's an astonishing thing, because when I look back on it now, having charted those 30 years after the assassination, yeah, that's a pretty big achievement. It's an astonishing achievement. And I think it's a story that deserves to be told. And I get very upset now when I see the kind of criticism, not just of that, but people saying, oh, she was cold, oh, she was unfeeling. I mean, this is a woman struggling to keep her mind intact and trying to raise her children in the middle of that. And she was very conscious of the toll that it could take on the children. I mean, I remember her writing a letter when they were still small and talking about their little shoulders. And she said, on their little shoulders, there's such a burden.
Mm.
And she meant, of course, that, you know, they've lost their father, but she also meant they're dealing with me in this condition. And she'd write about being frightened what this was going to do to them, and she managed to do it and to raise them well. And I think her story, the story of that struggle for history, deserves to be told properly.
Thank
and for her.
Thank you for telling it, Barbara. Thank you for being with us. Very interesting hour.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Barbara Leeming, the book is Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up momentarily. I will be cooking tomorrow doing Thanksgiving, so I won't be here. John Munson will be here. And during this hour, a look at the legacy of Mark Twain as it continues to flourish 100 years after his death. So John is with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Have a really wonderful, meaningful Thanksgiving day. And we'll be with you again next Monday on the Ideas Network.